Hello, everyone. This is Bob Seda. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. We'll be reading today in digest form the Quarter Century Wireless Association Journal for the spring of 2007. The editor is Douglas Wallbridge, P.O. Box 251, Hudson, Massachusetts, zip code 01749. And the business office is located in Framingham, Massachusetts. Their phone number is area 508-405-1930. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Hemp System in cooperation with QCWA. The Courage Handy Hemp System is located at 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. The material here is basically for use of eligible Handy Ham members and QCWA members. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. Handy Ham is spelled H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M. So again, handyham@courage.org. The website is www.handyham.org. First of all, I'm going to comment on a very colorful front cover of the magazine. It's headlined here, Celebrating 100 Years. That's charter member Ralph Hasslinger, called W2CVF, Whiskey 2, Charlie Victor Foxtrot. It says, Thanksgiving 2006 marked a significant milestone for our last charter member, Ralph Hasslinger, W2CVF. Ralph was 100 years old. Congratulations, Ralph. Now follows a short list of the QCWA officers and board directors, the names and call signs only. President John B. Johnson, W3BE. Vice President Leonard Nathanson, W8RC. Secretary Walter Supina, N3WS. Treasurer Frank Harris, WA4PAM. General Manager Chuck Wallbridge, K1IGD. Let's begin today from the President, John B. Johnston, W3BE, titled Welcome Sweet Springtime. Many of the comments that have been coming this way from members are about the report and order in WT Docket Number 04-140. The new provision in the vanity call sign system is of particular interest. It was our QCWA that filed a petition to allow the current holder of a call sign to designate which club, chapter, he or she desires to claim it under the in memoriam provision. Previously, only our relatives had that prerogative. We are now pursuing a new petition with the FCC. It requests a procedure whereby an amateur operator who is now serving or who in the past has served with our military is afforded the option to make notice of such service during the amateur station identification procedure. On appropriate occasions such as Veterans Day, Memorial Day, Armed Forces Day, and Independence Day, our military personnel and veterans could make known during their communications that they are serving or have served our country and the branch of the military in which they serve or have served. A codified system of indicators reserved for this purpose would facilitate the rapid recognition of their contributions by those having interest in such. It would be one small but meaningful way to honor those who have served us. The FCC's rules currently provide the option for one or more indicators to be included with the station call sign in the ID announcement. The proposal is for a system of indicators specifically reserved for this purpose. Your QCWA has requested that it be codified that when the control operator of the station is a current member or honorably discharged veteran of the military, a specific indicator may be included with the call sign identification announcement. The indicator would be according to a schedule consistent with the branch of service and radio call sign prefixes allocated to the United States. The amendment, which is printed boldly below this commentary, would be in addition to Section 97.119 sub C. One or more indicators may be included with the call sign. Each indicator must be separated from the call sign by the slant mark or by any suitable word that denotes the slant mark. If an indicator is self-assigned, it must be included before, after, or both before and after the call sign. No self-assigned indicator may conflict with any other indicator specified by the FCC rules or with any prefix assigned to another country. Now here's the bold print. When the control operator of the station is a current member or honorably discharged former member of the United States military, an appropriate indicator may be included with the call sign identification announcement. The following indicators are reserved for this purpose as follows. 1. Air Force, colon, forward slant, Air Force, in uppercase, or slant, AF, uppercase. 2. Army, colon, forward slant, Army, or slant, AA. 3. Navy, colon, forward slant, Navy, or slant, NA. 4. Marine Corps, colon, forward slant, Marines, or forward slant, NM. 5. Coast Guard, colon, forward slant, Coast Guard, or forward slant, ACG. Many of our FCC-authorized amateur operators are serving or have served with our military. Many have made valuable contributions to military electronics and communications as a result of their pre-service experience as amateur operators. Others became amateur operators during or following their military training in communications and electronics. The FCC rules already recognize this unique and mutually beneficial linkage. They authorize the grant of a military recreation amateur station license, which enables our amateur operators to continue the pursuit of their hobby even while serving duty at the military facility. They provide for the installation and operation of an amateur station on board a ship or aircraft, and they authorize our amateur stations transmitting on amateur service frequency channels to exchange messages cross-band with U.S. military stations transmitting on government frequency channels during an Armed Forces Day communications test. Our current military service personnel and veterans share a very unique common bond in the pride of having put aside a period from their personal lives in order to serve our country in a difficult and demanding endeavor. Those who are also amateur operators can often share this bond to an even greater extent. Favorable action on our petition will bring more meaning to them during those patriotic events honoring our military service personnel and veterans. Now changing the pace, recent visits. Visits with our chapters this past quarter included Colorado Chapter 58, Ocala, Florida, Suwannee Chapter 62, Sarasota, Florida, Sun Coast Chapter 53, Largo, Florida, Gator Chapter 32, St. Petersburg, Florida, Chapter 128 Picnic, and the Villages, Florida, Chapter 217. Welcome, sweet springtime. Make certain that our QCWA banner is flying proudly at all of your hamfests. 73, W3BE, slant, N-A. Now the report from our general manager, Chuck Walbridge, K. 1IGD, Spring 2007. Well, looks like we have six topics here that we're going to discuss, so we'll begin with Gremlins Are Back. I'm sure many of our members recall the source of the pesky problems which plagued many activities during World War II, gremlins. Don't look now, but they are back. They caused a mailing problem with the winter issue of the journal. The street address field was not transferred from the QCWA database. It was there, into the program used by the mailing vendor. The city, state, zip, country, field got printed twice. Some members were lucky to receive the first mailing. Most likely the address was a P.O. box, the last four digits of the zip code. Or you lived in a smaller community and were known by the postal employees. It was necessary to have a second printing and mailing at the vendor's expense. If you receive two copies, pass the extra copy along to a non-QCWA member. You just might enlist a new member. Chapter Report Form. The chapter report form mailed in December 2006 to each chapter secretary is important for two reasons. First, it is the one action required of each chapter to retain their chapter. Secondly, it serves as the basis of the active chapter list published each spring. Secretaries change, and since they are the primary contact for new members looking for information about your chapter, it is important that the list have current names, calls, and addresses. If yours has not been sent to headquarters, please take care of that now, and thanks. Member Directory. A recurring question received at headquarters is, why am I not listed in the Member Directory, which is posted on the web as a PDF file? The directory lists members whose dues were active as of June 30 of the year of issue. Since the bylaws state that members are not delinquent until 90 days after their expiration date, members whose dues were current back to March 31 are included. A new version will be prepared and posted mid-August. A CD with the PDF file will be available from headquarters for US$10 PPD after the file is posted. Dayton 2007. Like the change of seasons, the Dayton Hamvention, which is May 18, 19, and 20, 2007, is just around the corner. Our request has been submitted to be located in the same booth as last year, which is number 470. Be sure to stop by and say hello and visit for a while. Jan and I hope that by that time, all of our members who may have suffered through a snowbound winter will be thawed out and able to attend. See you then. Check their website for details on the Friday night QCWA banquet. Now the scholarship program. Just a reminder, the deadline is April 15th to request an application from Scholarship Committee, Foundation for Amateur Radio, P.O. Box 831, Riverdale, Maryland, M.D., 20738. Submission must be received by May 15th. The CUSO party dates for 2007, spring party, which has gone by, March 31 to April 1, the fall party, September 15 through 16, 2007. Log sheets are available from headquarters or on the QCWA web page. And there is a sidebar here. It's headed QCWA Bylaw Revised. The Board of Directors have voted using the email voting protocol to modify Article 6, Nominations and Elections, Section 6, fourth sentence, to read as follows. Quoting, ballots shall be mailed by April 1st of each election year to each member in good standing. The polls shall be open no less than 60 days after the date of ballot mailing. Election of those candidate positions which are contested shall be by written ballot vote of a plurality of those members voting before the close of the polls on July 15th. Those candidates who are not contested will not be listed on that ballot. Close quote. In accordance with Article 9, Amendments, Section 3, quoting, the membership shall be advised of any amendment to these bylaws at least 60 days prior to its becoming effective. Close quote. Secretary shall establish the effective date of this change. And this General Manager's report is signed 73, Chuck Walbridge, K1, IGD. Well, at the very beginning, I mentioned the cover of this particular issue, the Spring 2007 QCWA Journal. Now we have the cover story, celebrating 100 years. Charter member Ralph Haslinger, W2CVF, turns 100, by General Manager Chuck Walbridge, K1IGD. Thanksgiving 2006 marked a significant milestone for our last charter member, Ralph Haslinger, who was 100 years old. His granddaughter, Melanie Vanney, planned a birthday party which was attended by many family members. Some, Ralph indicated, he had never met before. I have summarized some of Ralph's background in the following material. Ralph was born in New York City in 1906 and moved to New Jersey in 1909. His original license was 2CVF in 1922. His first exposure to wireless was at a classmate's house in 1918. Ralph became interested in a wireless receiver that emitted intriguing dots and dashes, which he first thought came from the Brooklyn Navy Yard. His first homebrew receiver was built from an oatmeal box, some number 24 wire, a wooden frame, a slider to contact the coil on the oatmeal box, and a piece of galena and cat whisker. Audio was provided by a telephone receiver. The antenna was 100 feet of number 14 wire from the attic to a tree in the backyard. After finding the sensitive spot on the galena detector, dots and dashes were finally heard. Ralph was initially in the air with a Ford spark coil using his initials, which was the common practice at the time. He finally was licensed in 1922, taking his exam at the Custom House in New York with the legal call of 2, Charlie Victor Foxtrot. Over the years, Ralph expanded on his operating skills, eventually upgrading to more modern equipment. It was in the evening of Friday, December 5th, 1947, in an upstairs room of Papa's Restaurant in New York City, when Ralph and 33 other young men met to plan for something that would change amateur radio history. From an idea that had originated during a 10-meter net the month before, an organization to recognize the common bondage between those licensed for 25 years was to be created. All of them had started with Ford spark coil as a transmitter and worked their way up to a 1-kilowatt rotary gap transmitter, all on or about 200 meters. Ralph's original license indicated he could transmit on 180, 190, and 200 meters. All advanced in time to CW and to the frequencies we now know. When discussing the name for their new organization, Frank Lester, then W2AMJ, now a Silent Key, suggested quarter century to recognize the years of service and Wireless Association, to indicate an organization whose members had pioneered amateur radio from the days of wireless spark. The enthusiasm of the original 54 charter members to establish QCWA is the legacy we now live with. Ralph has been a generous benefactor of the QCWA Memorial Scholarship Fund. Through his contributions, many young hams have benefited in being able to become educated and move on to be productive members of our society. Thanks, Ralph. The next piece is from the GM. Here is an idea for a chapter project. Apparently, the author is Mark J. Schreiner, I think, S-C-H-R-E-I-N-E-R, call NK8Q, November Kilo 8, Quebec. The article begins, I'm Mark J. Schreiner, NK8Q. I've been an associate member of Chapter 17 for the past few years and helping him out with Field Day. The past couple of years, we decided to try something a little different. Usually, we would run 1A or 2A with 100-watt rigs, and like most stations, operating with the generator cranking away all weekend. Well, by a little different, we decided to try 2A battery QRP with my Elcraft K2 on single sideband, and Don called W3LR's K2 on CW. This was the first time our rigs were to be used in a contest, as we both finished building them within a couple of months prior to Field Day. We used the club call sign of W3GS as the QTH of Ray Bilger, W3TDF. His QTH is about 11 acres in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, and is finally referred to as Grumpy Acres. He has a great QTH, although it gets very hot, thus there are no shade trees, just a wide-open grassy field. Oh, we also have a VHF station and a GOTA station as well. The biggest problem is getting enough operators to keep the stations active. Anyway, in 2005, our first attempt at something different, we ended up getting fourth place in the ARRL event, about 25 points shy of third place, which was achieved by Tom N0SS, who convinced their club to also try something different for once. Well, that was encouraging, although at first there were many complaints about how difficult it was to operate QRP, especially true for the VHF operators, no doubt. We did pretty well, and those who were initially discouraged by our results got their spirits lifted. I heard from Tom and Zero SS that the consensus of their club was that it was a nice experiment, but they wouldn't ever be doing anything like that again. It sounded like that at first from some members of our team as well. However, like I say, we were more encouraged after seeing the overall results. So decided to do the same effort again this past year, 2006. Well, results came out in a recent QST magazine, and we ended up getting second place in the 2A battery category. This was quite encouraging as well. However, some analysis of the scoring seemed to have us interested in contacting the first place team to see how they were able to gather such a good score. We are anxious to learn how we can do better. I know that having more operators was one of the key differences for 2005, when all of the other teams that were in the top three had at least 18 operators, or more, while we had about one-third of that amount. However, having consistent high QSO rates throughout the whole contest must be the way to better scores. Anyway, we hope to have a dialogue with the first place team in hopes to learn how to give them better competition. I am also a member of QRP Slant ARCI, so I submitted our scores, both in 2005 and 2006, to that organization for their concurrent competition for Milliwatt Field Day. And in both cases, we got first place in the 2A battery competition. Note the certificate from this past year, which is reproduced at the very beginning of the article. We got a similar one the year before, 2005, which I passed along to our chapter secretary and treasurer, Mike Donio, K3NWM, for the club archives. Our chapter president, Ray, W3TDF, suggested I forward the certificate to the journal for possible publication in the newsletter. We hope to also have it published in our monthly chapter newsletter, and it is on our chapter website for others to see as well. 73, signed Mark Schreiner, NK8Q. Here's an interesting piece from the Vic Clark Chapter 91 QCWA in Maryfield, Virginia. It's headed, Chapter 91 celebrates the 400th anniversary of the founding of Jamestown. In 1607, a first permanent English settlement in the New World was founded on the east bank of a river, on a spit of land 40 miles upstream from where that river empties into the Atlantic Ocean. Its founders, some 100 in number, sailed over on three vessels, the Susan Constant, the Godspeed, and the Discovery. They landed first at Cape Henry, near what is now known as Virginia Beach. Seeking more secure location, they ventured upstream into what is now known as the James River, and they named their new settlement Jamestown. Both were named in honor of their king, James I. The Commonwealth of Virginia will be celebrating the 400th anniversary of that founding during the year 2007. The Vic Clark Chapter 91 of QCWA is joining in that celebration by offering an award to all licensed radio amateurs for confirmed contacts made on the amateur radio bands during 2007. This award, a colorful certificate 8 by 11 inches in size, which is pictured above here, will be available to all amateurs satisfying the requirements. And they are as follows. There are eight listings here. 1. The award will be issued for confirmed two-way contacts with 25 different stations in the state of Virginia during the quadricentennial year of 2007. Two, contacts must be between 0000 UTC, 1 January 2007, and 2400 UTC, 31 December 2007. Three, certificates will be serially numbered in the order issued and signed by the chapter president and treasurer. Four, contacts may be made on any frequency authorized for amateur use. Contacts through a repeater will not be creditable. Five, any mode legal on the frequency used will be acceptable. Six, applicants must submit a list of contacts claimed, including call, date, and time in UTC, Universal Time Constant, band slant frequency, mode, UTH, and name of operator. Each application must include a signed statement certifying the list to be accurate. 7. There will be a fee of $2 U.S. for applicants in North America. In parentheses, check, cash, or money order only. No credit cards or stamps accepted. Close parentheses. Certificates will be gratis to stations outside North America, but donations will be accepted. 8. Applications for the award will be accepted until 1 July 2008 at the following address. Vic, that's V-I-C, Clark, Chapter 9-1, QCWA, P.O. Box 4112. Merrifield, I'll spell, M-E-R-R-I-F-I-E-L-D, Merrifield, Virginia, VA, zip code 22166-4112. What follows next are chapter reports. I'll give you a little bit of information about this. Chapter reports are a very important part of the journal. We would like to see regular reports from all chapters. If your chapter is not represented on these pages, please ask your secretary to file a special report for the journal. Also, please send the reports to Chuck Walbridge, General Manager, to arrive no later than the following dates: January 1 for spring, April 1 for summer, July 1 for fall, and October 1 for winter. Attention, QCWA Chapter Report Guidelines. All future chapter reports will need to follow these limits set by the Publication Standing Committee, 500 words and 2 photos maximum. When taking photos, group together those receiving awards rather than individual photos. Those can always be posted on a chapter web page. When a chapter report is submitted, please include the chapter number in the title and with any photo submitted. Preferred formats for reports are Word, that's .doc, RTF, or plain text. Now, the following chapters are going to be acknowledged for their diligence in submitting reports. Chapter 1, Cleveland, Ohio. Chapter 2, Chicago area, Illinois. Chapter 10, Michigan. Chapter 16, Barry M. Goldwater, Arizona. Chapter 20, Baltimore, Maryland. Chapter 21, Canton, Ohio. Chapter 30, West Virginia. Chapter 41, Dallas, Texas. Chapter 53, Suncoast, Florida. Chapter 62, Suwannee, Florida. Chapter 65, Niagara Frontier, New York. Chapter 70, National Capital, Ontario, Canada. Chapter 85, Arklatex, Arkansas, Louisiana, Texas, Louisiana. Chapter 91, Vic Clark, Virginia. Chapter 102, Dakota. both North and South Dakota. Chapter 109, Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Chapter 112, Yankee, Massachusetts. Chapter 119, Tidewater, Virginia. Chapter 120, Quarter Century Wireless Women, QCWW. Chapter 126, Piedmont, North Carolina. Chapter 128, Pelican and 32, Gator, Florida. Chapter 146, Twin State Chapter, New Hampshire. Chapter 149, Nutmeg, Connecticut. Chapter 151, Wild Rose, Alberta, Canada. Chapter 154, Leo Meyerson, Greater Palm Springs, California. Chapter 169, Sacramento Valley, California. Chapter 196, Edison, Florida. Chapter 213, Fresno, California. Chapter 214, Bluegrass, Kentucky. Chapter 217, The Villages, Florida. That completes the list of those chapters who have reported. They put a lot of time and effort into this. It's very detailed information, a lot of call signs and things like that, which we can't possibly give so much time to by word. So if you want to get more information on a particular chapter, have someone help you read the material from a copy that they may have at hand. Our next commentary is all about the kickoff of the 60th anniversary of the Quarter Century Wireless Association in Denver, Colorado, at the 2007 International QCWA Convention, the dates 4 through 7, October 2007. For more information, after you hear this, there's a website, http://qcwa-58.rmhcn.org/convention/. Here are the facts. Headquarters Hotel, the DoubleTree Hotel, 3203 Quebec Street, Denver, Colorado, 80207. A block of single or double rooms are available for $113.70. That's actually $99 plus the taxes. For reservations, call the hotel toll-free at the following 800 number. 1-800-222-TREE, or 1-800-222-8733, or locally, area 301-321-3333, and mention QCWA 2007 for this special rate. The hotel has a complimentary airport shuttle, restaurant, fitness center, high-speed internet, as well as many other amenities to help make your visit an enjoyable one. Now for activities. Informational and entertaining presentations and seminars on Friday and Saturday, including station grounding procedures, the QCWA forum, health and safety tips for the shack, amateur radio operations from the South Pole, an IARU update, and much more. Friday night's meet and greet will feature the 4th U.S. Artillery Regimental Brass Band for your listening pleasure while you mingle. Check the website to see the schedule as it develops. Now regarding tours, an exciting variety of tours and activities are available here in colorful Colorado. Although difficult to choose what to highlight, your host chapter has arranged an impressive selection for you, including Thursday, bus tours to the Black Hawk and the Central City gambling casinos, shuttle buses for shopping galore at one of Denver's newest shopping centers, as well as the famous 16th Street Mall in downtown Denver. Friday, the Denver Mint and Wings Over the Rockies Air and Space Museum. Saturday, the famous Georgetown Loop Railroad. And Sunday, a visit to the United States Air Force Academy, lunch at Colorado Springs Garden of the Gods, topped literally with a trip to the summit of 14,110-foot Pikes Peak. Oh, boy. Via the world-famous Cog Railway. Check your health and altitude precautions, folks. So, for more attractions, if our scheduled tours don't interest you, Colorado certainly has much more to offer. Museums, the zoo, parks, shopping, Rocky Mountains majesty, way too many to list. Check our web links for just a few of the many activities you can easily find and enjoy on your own. Souvenirs. Be sure to get your QCWA 60th anniversary commemorative pin, available now if you check the website, or at a discount with your convention registration. Many of the collectible items will be available at the convention. Can't forget the prizes. An assortment of drawings and door prizes are planned. We are grateful to our many sponsors and contributors who, with their support, are helping to make the QCWA 2007 convention a memorable one. The anniversary year with a bang. Now regarding registration. Registration is available now. Use a registration form in this issue or download it from the internet and print out a blank copy to complete by hand or fill it in on your computer to print a legible copy to mail with your payment. Your form and payment must be received through the mail to confirm your registration. Your host, established on 11 November 1971, Colorado Chapter 58 is proud to welcome you to colorful Colorado and our Rocky Mountains High. Well, folks, let's go as time allows now to Random Recollections of an Old Ham. This is a continuing story that you've been listening to for the last year or so. This one is titled The Last 12 Years at ARRL Headquarters, a journalistic history of the life and times in amateur radio of George Hart, W1NJM. The last 12 years at ARRL headquarters were the hardest of my total of 39 years and 8 months. I was still in control of public service operating, but had many other responsibilities as well, so most of the detail work had to be delegated. Bill Mann handled it quite adequately, but I missed getting my hooks into the meat of the problems. Chuck Bender handled W1AW quite adequately, but there was trouble with and getting some of the operators to work with him. Bob White handled DXCC adequately, but here also assistants were hard to come by. Lillian Salter performed her function as my administrative assistant more than adequately under Ellen's supervision, but occasionally a problem would arise requiring a decision on my part. Contests ran quite smoothly under Ellen's supervision and guidance. Rapid turnover personnel was one of the biggest problems, the chief obstacle to finding qualified people being the low salary ranges. I tried to impress on all newcomers, all of whom I interviewed personally, that my policy was to promote from within if possible, but only if an underling had acquired sufficient experience and knowledge to do the job right. At one point, I drew up a proposal for revising the league's divisional plan and bucked it into John, who turned it over to Perry Williams, who gave it an unenthusiastic endorsement. The plan then existing, as it still does accept that Canada is no longer a part of it, divided the league's operating territory into 16 divisions. I determined the total full voting membership of each division and discovered that the Atlantic Division, which had the most full members, had 6 times as many as the Dakota Division, which had the least, but only one director was selected from each division. This meant that a full, licensed member in the Dakota Division had 6 times the Board of Directors' representation as a full member in the Atlantic Division, a hugely disproportionate figure. To rectify this situation, I divided the total full membership of the league by 16 to arrive at the ideal number of full members in each division, so that each member would have equal representation on the board. How to redivide the United States and Canada so that the quotient could be arrived at without making division boundaries too arbitrary and complicated. I decided on call areas to be the best possible base, So calculate the full membership in each call area. It, too, of course, was highly disproportionate. So I propose that each call area with full membership more than the above quotient elect two directors, while each call area below the quotient elect only one. On this basis, the total number of directors would be 16, exactly the same as at present. The number of members represented by each director would still be disproportionate, but not nearly so much as the present system. The Heartland of Division relocation received little notice. It was generally considered unworkable, too complex, and there were too many what-ifs. I had answers for all the questions, but received no questions. John Huntoon told me that even if the plan was presented to the board, it would never get through, for both political reasons and the reasons of discontinuity. There was no outcry against the present system, so why change it? Why stir up trouble? I gave up, but kept the plan in my files for many years. It has probably long since been thrown out. The policy of if it ain't broke, don't fix it prevailed. But a corollary to this might be, if the plan works, don't improve it. If we all followed this policy, we would still be using Spark, and our national constitution would have no amendments. Besides, I was only the league's communications manager. Where did I get off meddling with the league's basic structure? Sometime in the early 70s, John Huntoon came into my office and announced that he was retiring. He still had a few years to go before mandatory retirement, so I was shocked at his decision. He was replaced by Dick Baldwin. This wasn't automatic either, but Dick had the ardent support of League President Harry Daniels, and there was little opposition. I got along well enough with Dick, but I always had a funny feeling that he considered me not fully qualified for the job I held, although I doubt if he considered replacing me. As my retirement approached, I've made another suggestion outside my department, and this one was adopted, perhaps partly because it concerned only headquarters management. Dick had been John's general assistant, but so far as I knew, without specific duties. I proposed to Dick that he appoint two assistant general managers to serve as buffers between him and the various department heads. The two AGMs, each to supervise half the departments, leaving he, GM, more time to handle his many other problems with government and the board of directors. It was my understanding that the principal reason for John's early retirement had been pressure from the board of directors. I had expected to be turned down on this one, too, so was quite surprised when Dick came into my office and told me he was adopting my suggestion and that he was appointing David Sumner and Bob Myers, both fairly new to the staff, to be his AGMs. I believe Dick thought I had expected or hoped to be one of the two AGMs, if the suggestion was adopted. But this was not so. I made the suggestion entirely detached from personalities, as was my usual practice, with the overall benefit my only objective. So I'm sorry if this seems like under the circumstances, but it happens to be true. I don't think I would have accepted if he had appointed me, because I didn't feel I had enough familiarity with the operation of other departments to handle it properly. I was too much wedded to the CD. Dick said that my department would be one of those under Dave Sumner's jurisdiction, and asked if I had any objection. I replied in the negative, although I did have reservations. Dave was a brilliant young man, but he had been on the staff only a few years, and I felt a little short of experience and perhaps maturity. I did not voice these reservations. My Army experience had taught me how to behave under such conditions, and I felt sure I could handle it, given adequate cooperation by Dave. I passed the word on to Ellen, and she seemed quite unperturbed. Unfortunately, I did not work well under Dave. Whether his fault or mine, I have never been sure. Perhaps I was too conscious of the differences in our age. He was 27. I was 63. In our amateur radio experience, 50 years for me, 10 or so for Dave. In our time at HQ, 38 years for me, 5 for Dave. To take seriously his assumptions of superiority over me, I tried very hard to apply the old Army philosophy of respect for the rank, not necessarily for the individual, but it wouldn't wash. I did respect Dave's superior intelligence. He was every bit as good a CW operator as I, far superior in technical knowledge, probably superior in knowledge of government as it applied to amateur radio. And yet, when he sat in my office and lectured me on the principles of ARRL and business management, I could not help but feel the incongruity of the situation, not to mention its ludicrous aspect. No, I didn't laugh. It wasn't funny. He was my boss. I had to do as he ordered. I knew Dick Baldwin would back him up, for Dick seemed to have what seemed to me a totally illogical worship for Dave's latent ability. Perhaps it all started when Dick decided to request all department heads and their immediate assistants to take a course in business management offered by a firm specializing in this subject. The course would be taught by Laird Campbell, WNCUT, who was then high in the league's editorial department, and Dave Sumner, both of whom would be furnished with detailed instructions by the firm on how to conduct these courses. Ellen and I were the two students from the CD. We gathered, I don't remember how often, in the conference room off the lobby. From the very beginning, I looked askance at the entire program, which was obviously designed for management of manufacturing firms, most of the precepts being inapplicable to a nonprofit membership organization, and I so expressed myself. Dick agreed to an extent, but said it was the only such course available, that the firm producing it had an excellent reputation, and that most of the basics applied to any business corporation, including the league. I did not agree. I never looked at the league as a business, but as a sort of union devoted 100% to the benefit of its members with no profit motives. However, I received little, if any, support from my fellow students and backed off. I was a good loser and devoted myself to learning what I could from the course. As I look back, I feel I was partially right, partially wrong, but mostly the former. I learned a few things I hadn't known about management, but still thought most of the methods entirely inapplicable to our kind of operation, and teaching them just so much time wasted. My management of the CD did not change one iota as a result. Two other incidents occurred during my last 2 years which turned me against Dave Sumner. The details are a little vague, but at one point a grievous error was made in the compilation of the net directory, which was not discovered until after it had been printed, resulting in a necessity to reprint it at a cost to the league of thousands of dollars. Since the directory was compiled in my department, I took full responsibility for the error, particularly in the fact that I had completely delegated the function and did not maintain close supervision. Dave called me, Ellen, and the person who made the error into his office, and there gave me a thorough dressing down. That was okay, I deserved it, but I thought it highly inappropriate for him to do so in front of two of my staff. I was already greatly embarrassed by the error, but highly incensed with the way he had handled it, which I felt showed a definite lack of maturity. The other incident occurred after Ellen had announced her resignation. During the last year before my mandatory retirement, it was generally assumed that Ellen would succeed me as communications manager. To me, it was a foregone conclusion, and she gave me no hint of any developments to the contrary. But in retrospect, I should have seen the handwriting on the wall. Bob's assistant in DXCC took over this function. It developed that the transfer was, in effect, a drastic downgrade. Bob's new function was in the handling of the ARRLQSL Bureau, a demanding enough task in itself, but under the direction of the league's mailroom, which was managed at the time by a woman not a licensed amateur. Bob found the situation completely untenable and proposed to resign and seek employment elsewhere. He and Ella must have discussed it at some length, And over a period of time, I knew about Bob's situation upstairs and sympathized with him. I had protested vociferously when he was ordered to transfer, but to no avail. It was a board mandate which Dick and Dave appeared to agree with. Don Search was a good man and could handle the XCC very well, but he was no Bob White. I accepted the situation without realizing the impact it could have on the CD. Perhaps I should have made more of a ruckus, but I'm sure it would not have changed the ultimate decision and consequences. Most likely I was one of the last to know that we had not only lost Bob, but Ellen also. During that last year, many inquiries from the field were made as to who would take my place as communications manager. I had replied with confidence and assurance that it would be Ellen White. But 2 weeks before my retirement date, I found in my inbox a long memo from Ellen announcing her intention to resign and go with Bob to live in Florida. It was a shattering blow. I called Dave on the office phone and told him we had a problem. You mean because of Ellen's resignation? This was a second blow. It seemed nearly everyone in the office but I knew about it. I was deeply humiliated, angry with Ellen for not cluing me in far beforehand. It seemed the decision had been made weeks before. With myself for not having an ear for office scuttlebutt. Dick and Dave seemed not at all concerned about my replacement. In fact, Dick proposed jokingly that after my department, Dave could spend 10 minutes in my office every day and accomplish everything I normally accomplished. Dave said that he was happy with Ellen's resignation because, quoting, "now I can select my own communications manager." This was the third blow. His communications manager. They seemed to think it strange that I was so concerned about who would replace me. They didn't seem to realize or understand that I was concerned about the welfare and future of ARRL as a strong advocate of its raison d'etre, not just of my part in it. I wanted the CD to have a strong leader, such as I knew Ellen would have been, and such as Ed Handy had been, and I felt very concerned with who it would be. I recommended John Lindholm, WNDGL, who had worked with us during several summers on a temporary basis and had done much good work. But John, by then a high school teacher, preferred to stay on his current job. The next possibility was Bill Mann, who had resigned his position as ACM for public service to go back to his native Maine. But Bill's wife was not willing to come back to Connecticut, so he reluctantly declined. The day of my departure, in the afternoon, Louise came to pick up some personal items I wanted to take home. I usually walked or rode my bike. While she was there, I had a visit from a representative of Cigna, who presented me with a check for $120,000, representing my retirement fund, which I had opted to take in a lump sum rather than a monthly stipend of a little over $700. Louise, who was slated to retire from Aetna Life Insurance Company the following month, was greatly impressed. After I had loaded the car with my personal belongings and she had left, Dick Baldwin stopped in and wished me well, sat and talked for a few minutes. I don't recall that Dave even so much as bade me farewell. Regrettably, Dave and I didn't seem to hit it off during those last 2 years, which were extremely uncomfortable for me as a result, and which he could have made much easier with a more conciliatory attitude. Was it my fault? I don't think so, and still don't, but I doubt if it ever bothered him. It bothered me for years afterward because Dave succeeded Dick as general manager and then, following a sweeping reorganization, as executive vice president, reducing his power and giving the board of directors more of an oar in headquarters management. The communications department was abolished and its functions divided up among several other headquarters entities. By that time, John Lindholm had been lured back from his teaching job to take over as communications manager and became prominent in the reorganized headquarters. I don't remember in exactly what capacity. My retirement occurred on November 1, 1978, my 65th birthday. Louise retired from the Aetna on December 1, just a month later. On December 4, we were on our way to Florida to spend our first of 16 winters there in Bonita Springs, where my brother Ed, then N4KB, lived with his wife and our mother. Before leaving the subject of my almost 40 years at ARRL headquarters, I want to cover several events that occurred during that period that were overlooked in the above, some hinging on my job, some not. The first and most important of these is clubs and field day. Already covered have been my early years membership in the Lehigh Valley Amateur Radio Club. The college years and subsequent move to Connecticut pretty much severed my relationship to this club, of which I had been one of the earliest, but not the founding member I was. However, a founding member of the Newington Amateur Radio League in 1946 and the Connecticut Wireless Association in 1947. NARL was formed from the WERS amateurs during World War II, and I was its first president after returning from Army service in 1946. Actually, however, Charlie McLeod, W1AVN, served as president pro tem until my return, when he turned the presidential reins over to me. I served only one term, then was kicked out because the members didn't like my high-handed discipline in meetings. I was defeated by Don Spencer, a non-ham at the time, who later moved to Florida, Englewood, and obtained his ham ticket. Don was a pretty special guy and a good friend. I met him at several get-togethers of hams in Florida, and we kept promising each other to renew acquaintances, but never did. The Newington Club members were not my kind of hams. I believe Don was the only non-amateur to serve as president. But the only reason he was not a ham was because he didn't care for the code, which he learned well enough to get his license while in Florida. I felt then and still feel that anyone not being familiar with the Morse code is missing out on a major part of ham radio, although less so now than in the 40s. About a year after I returned from the Army, I started hosting meetings in my ham shack in the basement of my home, right here on Highland Street. We called it the Thursday Night Group, consisting of myself, Joe Mosky, Doc Hayes, Rod Newkirk, Tom McMullen, Mary Powell, and possibly a few others. It was not really a club, just a few hams getting together for bull shooting and general palaver. But eventually we decided to form a club to be called the Connecticut Wireless Association. We were all CW men, and our principal activity became field day. More about CWA's participation in field day later. Field day was established by F.E. Handy, W1BDI, as a test of portables, and became a major annual operating activity sponsored by ARRL. In June of 1933, I had just completed my freshman year at Penn State and didn't hear about that first field day. I'm not sure that's what it was called that first year, but the name became legendary in the years to come as the ARRL-sponsored activity with the greatest number of participants. I was, however, a participant in the second field day and nearly everyone since up to the present day. In 1934, Ed and I put up a tent at the woodshed on our farm in Cedar Valley. We operated entirely on batteries using entirely homemade equipment, and if my memory serves me correctly, we made a total of 12 contacts in 24 hours using the call W3NF slant 3. I was 19, Ed was 23. We slept in the tent and were eaten by the mosquitoes, moths, and June bugs flocked to the light from our gasoline lantern. The transmitter was a 45 tube and a Hartley circuit running perhaps 5 watts, and the receiver a regenerative using a pair of 30s. The woodshed was a wooden structure at the far eastern part of the property, originally put up by our father. It contained an open area in the middle of which had been a sawmill, which locked the shed to store blasting equipment at one end and another shed at the other end to serve as temporary living quarters. This had started as a temporary building on the site of a future mansion, the idea being to use the many trees for lumber to build my house and dynamite to blast the many rocks and stumps to clear the land and use the crushed rock to build a driveway from the county road about half a mile away. But Professor Ed Hart had passed away in 1931, and the woodshed was another abandoned relic of an uncompleted project. We did not use any of the woodshed facilities, such as they were, but camped in the open in our little wall tent. The big old stone farmhouse where we lived was a scant half mile away along the ridge of Sellers Hill and with a connecting primitive dirt road through the woods, but we stayed in our little tent on Saturday night despite the temptation to break camp and return to the comforts of the house. I remember that first field day very well, but there were several others between then and 1938, all at or near the same site. I don't believe we missed a single one, at least one of which was with the Delaware Lehigh Radio Club, with which Ed had become affiliated. But the details are long forgotten. I did miss the 1938 field day when I was still at Penn State trying to finish my master's thesis. In 1939, 40, and 41, I attended field day with the ARRR L Communications Department gang. These took place on the grounds of the Crippled Children's Home and Hospital in Newington. The cabin had been built in the woods adjoining the home, used by the Boy Scout troop for crippled kids, and Ed Handy had obtained permission for us to use it on that weekend. The cabin was in a very poor radio location near the bottom of Cedar Mountain off Cedar Street in Newington, nestled in among tall trees. Although we had some fine operators in the CD, we usually lost out in the annual competition with another field day group from headquarters called the South Lyme Beer, Chowder, and Propagation Society, consisting mostly of members of the secretarial and technical departments. K.B. Warmer, A.L. Budlong, John Huntoon, George Grammer, and Brian Goodman, plus a few others. This group set up at Budlong's place on Long Island Sound, a much better location than we had. Of course, there were no field days during the war years of 1942, 43, 44, and 45. But by June of 1946, things were about back to normal and the activity was renewed. Unfortunately, since I was still in the Army in Germany, I missed the 1946 field day. But by 1947, I was resettled at good old 66 Highland Street in Newington and went out with the CD gang at the Boy Scout cabin again. This time we had, besides the ubiquitous Ed Handy, Joe Muskie, Doc Hayes, Al Hill, Tom McMullen, and a few others, all excellent CW operators, and we racked up a good score, only to find out that South Chowder had again beaten us by a good margin. We had the bulk of good operators, but not such a good location. Even so, because our final score had been so much higher than any previous year, we expected to beat them. It was a devastating blow to our morale, and we took a lot of intra-office kidding about it. Ladies and gentlemen, in the next installment, George Hart will continue the narrative about the Connecticut Wireless Association. I'll conclude this reading of the QCWA Journal for the spring of 2007 with a continuation of the article titled Geeks, G-E-E-K-S. It's a chapterized book about growing up as a kid, ham, in Da Big Apple by Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF, and it's edited by Luann Keig, KB6HP. So you ask, how did this scribe get into ham radio? It was the summer of 1959. It happened because I had failed a course in trigonometry and was making it up in summer school. I was not alone. Everyone in our class had failed, and some were no dummies. One of my fellow alumni went on to be a physicist. He had straight A's in all his other courses, but not in trig. Nope. It was not that our class could not comprehend the mathematics. We couldn't comprehend the teacher. I won't give you his name. He is gone now, and so let's let proverbial sleeping dogs lie. But we will call him Teacher X, and Teacher X had a communications problem. He never talked. Not as in he had nothing to say. This guy never, ever uttered a word. No, he wasn't physically handicapped. He conversed well with other teachers outside the classroom, but not with students. When it came to dealing with us kids, either inside or outside of the classroom, he was mum. In fact, we nicknamed him Mr. Quiet. In his classroom, all communication from him to the class was written in chalk on a squeaky blackboard. No matter what questions you asked, the answer was always a long time in coming as it eked out of his hand in bold white letters. Another problem with Teacher X was that nobody ever passed the final exam. By the time I got to his class, he had been teaching trig for over 3 decades. A long time later, I learned that in the 30 years, he had never given any student a passing grade. Today, to fail an entire class, class after class, year after year, probably means a congressional investigation of the person's fitness to teach. But back then, it was not unusual to have entire classes fail a subject and no administrator asking anything. And if a parent complained, he or she was told that they had a stupid kid. After all, it was the 1950s. Anyhow, let me set the scene. I am attending summer school in Brooklyn, New York. It's hot and humid. There is no air conditioning. The topic is boring. Worst of all, the girls are about 5 miles away, romping in the surf at Coney Island. Yes, there was a day when it was safe to romp in the surf at a New York City beach. You don't want to do that these days, not if you want to keep on romping. Then I met the X. The X was only a nickname based on his call sign back then, W-A-2-A-K-X, Charles Sussman. To me, he was just Charlie. While we were in the same summer class, Charlie was there by choice, his father's choice of get a summer job or go to school. Charlie viewed school as the lesser of two evils. Charlie also rode to summer school on the train as I did. The train, in this case, was the New York City West End Subway. This in itself is a contradiction of terms, since the West End, or B train, as it is now called, is elevated about 50 feet above ground for most of its Brooklyn run. Anyhow, Charlie and I began talking one day on the West End Subway heading to Coney Island Station, where we would change for the last part of the ride home. He to the Culver line and me to the old Sea Beach line. Day after a hot day, we would climb the stairs, show our student passes, and wait on the sticky platform for the train to come. And we would talk. Soon, we became friends. Then, one day, Charlie suggested I come home with him to see the ham radio station he was building. "You're a ham?" I exclaimed. "Do you know Babs?" He looked at me, bewildered for a moment, and asked how I knew about Babs. I told him the story of spending time playing in K2IXN's radio store and of the old radio transmitter on the bench. "That must have been an SCR-522 with a 2-meter converter, and yes, I know Babs," he said. Having nothing better to do, I went with Charlie to his station on the Culver line, and then we walked a few blocks to his house. I called to tell my mom I would be a little late because I made a new friend, and I was going to look at his ham station. My mother, who knew nothing about radio other than how to tune in one man's family on our tabletop Emerson, said,
"Okay, but don't eat any. It's not kosher."
Trust me, I did not try to explain. At least not then. July rolled unto August. I spent more and more time at Charlie's house. While he had a ham station, it was not a working ham station. As with most kid hams of the day, he was trying to make it better. And as such, it was never really ready to go on the air. So we steadied Trig together and played electronic things, trying out different circuits from something called the ARRL Handbook, circuits that never seemed to perform exactly as claimed. It never even occurred to us that this might have been because we never had the money to buy the proper parts and were always scrounging used stuff from radio stores. Anyhow, it was mid-August when it happened. Charlie and I were on the elevated subway, headed to Coney Island Station, surrounded by lots of cute girls headed to the beach and oblivious to their existence. No, we were debating the pros and cons of plate modulation versus screen grid modulation. A hot topic of the day, no doubt. Suddenly, Charlie stopped mid-sentence, thought for a moment, and exclaimed, "Bill, I just realized you ain't a ham." What an amazing revelation after 2 months of talking every day. And he goes on to ask, "Why ain't you a ham?" So I gave him the stock answer of, "I don't have the time to sit down and learn that damn morose code." Yes, back then I called it the morose code. I thought that's what its name really was, because it was so hard to learn. Charlie quickly corrected me. "It's Morse code, named after Samuel F.B. Morse, the great inventor who created it," he told me. I responded, "With Morse to morose, I still have no time to learn it." Charlie's answer was short and sweet. "If you don't pass your tests in 2 weeks, I am going to beat you up." Now, I have not yet described Charlie, but as a teen, he was a full head taller than me, weighed probably twice what I did, played football, and that's something I did not, muscles. So when Charlie said he would beat me up, I took it serious. Talk about motivation to learn CW. He gave me an old and worn ARRL study guide and a handwritten copy of the code. Within 48 hours, I had memorized every dot and every dash and knew what they meant. Every day, Charlie would say, "You only have such and such number of days left." So I sent off for my novice test as I spent the rest of the time building my code speed to the needed 5 words per minute. Friends, I am living proof that incentive licensing really does work. But it only does so if you give a person the incentive of learning CW as opposed to having his body rack with pain. Do that, and I promise that he will learn the code, and he will pass the test. Trust me, I know from personal experience. When I called Charlie late that September to tell him that the FCC had given me the call sign WN2HVK, he not only congratulated me, but also told me that he had never had any plans to beat me up. It was just his way of giving me the incentive to get moving. At the ARRL pushed Charlie's brand of incentive licensing, I doubt that we would have today's no-code tech. As a postscript, I lost track of Charlie for over 2 decades. One day, I was on the phone with another old ham friend back in New York and asked about him. It turns out that Charlie went into the literary career and is currently a newspaper editor. He also sports an extra class ticket and the call sign WE2R, thanks to the internet and email. He is never very far away. And in the end, the word friendship, be it as a child, a teen, or a grown-up, is really what our hobby is all about. So I say, thank you, Charlie. Your friendship when we were teens helped guide me to a life and career that might otherwise not have come my way. To be continued. DEWA6ITF. The author, Bill Pasternak. Geeks, a chapterized book about growing up as a kid ham in the Big Apple. We'll continue in the next QCWA Journal. Folks, my name is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. You've been listening to the Quarter Century Wireless Association Journal for the spring of 2007. In digest form, the editor, Douglas Walbridge, P.O. Box 251, Hudson, Massachusetts, 01749. The president of QCWA, John B. Johnston, W3BE. This audio digest version of the QCWA Journal is a production of the Courage Hand Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members, and of course, for eligible QCWA members as well. If any of you would like more information about the Handy Ham System, Handy Hams can be reached at area 763-520-0512. Or at their email address, handyham@courage.org. The website is www.handyham.org. Thanks again for listening along with me here on the Courage Handy Ham System.